It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More than 23,000 households in Pittsburgh spend more than 50% of their income on housing. That's according to a needs assessment conducted by the City of Pittsburgh. The tenants are severely cost-burdened and vulnerable to eviction and then homelessness. The nonprofit, nonpartisan Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, has been working with low-income tenants to know their rights. It's one of the many projects of the organization that monitors the judiciary in our state. Maida Malone is the president and CEO of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. Maida, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
Your organization is holding a series of town halls, forums to inform tenants of their legal rights. How do these awareness education activities fit into the overall mission of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts?
They are really integral to it, as a matter of fact. We are focused, of course, on the judicial system, reforming it, making sure that it's modernized so that all residents of Pennsylvania have access to justice. Mm-hmm. And so our advocacy and legislative efforts really need to be paired with grassroots community efforts so that we're not only changing the system, but we're educating everyone who uses the system to know it well, to be able to navigate it, and to know their rights.
Your organization's been around for decades, and I think probably when I first heard of it, it might have been advocating for merit selection of appellate judges or some other big policy issue at the state level. When did you start getting involved sort of at the grassroots community level on issues that affect everyday people, such as low-income tenants?
We started doing that several years ago when I joined the organization. I have run a number of nonprofits, and most of them have been focused on community action and helping people where they live and work. So it was a natural for me to come into the organization and, of course, continue to press our advocacy and legislative efforts, but also to make sure that reform happens not only from 30,000 feet, but at the grassroots level. And so if we don't educate people about the judicial system, what good are we doing ultimately?
According to your website, your mission to, quote, ensure that all Pennsylvanians can come to courts with confidence they will be heard by qualified, fair, and impartial judges, end quote. Are you concerned? Do you believe that this might not be the case in some local courts, whether it's Philadelphia, Erie, Pittsburgh, wherever, when it comes to eviction cases?
Well, I think we are concerned about that, particularly given the rate of evictions. And so our approach to this is to try to support tenants, landlords, and the local magisterial district judges here in Allegheny County, educating them all about each other, about what their rights are, about the process, because I think fear comes from lack of knowledge, right? We always say knowledge is power.
Right.
So if you know your rights, if you're familiar with the process of landlord-tenant disputes, if the magisterial district judges have a better feel for the folks who are coming before them and the issues that they're facing personally, the results have to be better for everyone.
What drew you to this particular issue, eviction?
Well, we have a number of these workshops and programs in Philadelphia County, mm-hmm. which is where our organization is headquartered. But I'm a native Pittsburgher, and I love my hometown and spend time here. And Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts is a statewide organization. So spending time in Pittsburgh and having conversations with folks at the Pittsburgh Foundation, who are very involved in the eviction issue, decided that this was the right program for us at this moment, because it's what's needed most in this fifth judicial district.
You sort of allude to that you're sort of trying to bring all the parties together, whether
yes.
it's the tenant, the landlord, even the district judges. What is your sense of the overall understanding or not understanding of the rights of individuals and the role of the courts?
I think there is generally a lack of knowledge about the judicial system and particularly about the landlord-tenant dispute process. So what we're very excited about is watching landlords, tenants, judges together at these forums, at these workshops, coming to better understand each other and their rights. In addition to holding the workshops, we've published an original handbook on landlord-tenant disputes, and we've distributed thousands of them already in Allegheny County, and we're just about to publish our second edition. People are requesting caseloads of the handbooks because they're so valuable. It's hard to know your rights. Even if you're a lawyer, if you're a practicing lawyer, if you practice in a particular court, you know, you don't really understand how the other courts work. So everyone needs information about the judicial system.
And you are partnering with different district judges, different district magistrates on these forums across the state?
We are, particularly here in Allegheny County, and will begin to do them in other counties. Philadelphia County is a bit different because we don't have magisterial district judges in Philadelphia County. We have municipal court, and there is a housing court there, so the process is a bit different. But yes, otherwise around the state, we hope to expand these workshops and to tailor handbooks to the, you know, particular needs of landlords and tenants in those different districts.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is the president and CEO of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, Maida Malone. Your organization, nonpartisan, but it does take positions on issues such as merit selection for judges in our state appeals courts, whether it's state supreme, superior, commonwealth courts. Is that an issue you continue? I think that might be the first issue that I recall when I first heard of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. Is that still one of the key issues for your organization?
It is. It is. It has been at the heart of the organization's mission since we were founded 30 years ago. This is our 30th anniversary year. And yes, it is. It's still key to the work that we're doing. We feel that it's very important that, particularly for these statewide races, where most people enter the voting booth and have no idea who the judges are, that we have a process for selecting them that's based on merit, on their judicial temperament, on their experience, on their commitment to community, and not necessarily on name recognition, ballot position, or whether they're great fundraisers, which really is not a key element of being a great jurist.
It seems like every legislative session, a bill is introduced to switch to a merit selection process, but it doesn't happen. And we should remind our listeners that this would involve a change to the Pennsylvania Constitution, correct?
Yes, it would. So that makes this a bit of a gauntlet. We have to get through the legislature in two consecutive sessions with identical bills. And then there's a ballot referendum. So at the end of the day, this is up to the voters of Pennsylvania, whether they prefer to have appellate judges elected or whether they'd prefer to have a citizens nominating commission with a diverse group of people on it, bipartisan, evaluate candidates and select a slate for the governor to choose from and then the Senate to confirm.
Right. One more follow up on that is it's interesting because in the end, under this process that it would take, it would be voters deciding to give up their right to vote for judges or potential judges.
I mean, it's interesting. You can put it that way. And I suppose technically that's true. But at the end of the day, what I always say is we aren't taking the vote away from the voters. They will choose whether or not to change the system. The system won't apply to magisterial district judges or common pleas court judges. So the local judges you know well and can thoughtfully elect, you will continue to do that. Appointed judges will stand for retention elections 4 years after they're appointed to the bench. So we all get 4 years of information about them and how they function on the bench. And then we can say yes or no.
Are you more hopeful this time? I mean,
I am.
Has there been momentum building toward this?
There is. There is momentum. Last year, we got the bill farther than we ever have before. And this year, I think we're really poised to be able to get it through both houses. We've got great leadership this time around and more awareness, I think, of the issue and more sensitivity, I think, to what happens, how much money is beginning to influence the election of our judges.
We have about a minute and a half left, and I wanted to get to this before you go. So much over the last several months, maybe a year, we've heard at the federal level, state level, county level, criminal justice reform. And one aspect that Governor Wolf has proposed is bail reform, especially for low-income defendants who might qualify in every legal sense to be out of jail pending their court case. But they just can't afford it. Do you take a position on bail reform?
Yes, we do. We've been very actively involved in Philadelphia County. We established what's called Philly Bail Watch, and we've trained nearly 100 volunteers to go into municipal court and watch the bail hearings. The data that they collected, we published in a report and recommendations to the DA, to the First Judicial District. We had great momentum, and then our colleagues at the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the First Judicial District, and so our ex parte conversations with them have to cease now that the litigation is pending, but very involved in that and hoping to bring our Bail Watch program to Allegheny County.
And any idea when that might happen? I know it's dependent upon this suit, but do you have a timetable?
For bringing it here?
Yes.
Yes, we're hoping to do that in the next couple of months.
All right. Maida Malone is the president and CEO of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. Maida, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Loved it.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. New York Times White House correspondent Maggie Haberman has a long history of reporting on businessman turned president Donald Trump. She joins us ahead of her lecture at Chatham University to talk about how she approaches covering a president keen on battling with the press. Do you know someone with a perspective or project worth sharing? What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm or leave us a voicemail at 412-315-6778. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, singer Christina Aguilera performs the national anthem at the last home opener in Three Rivers Stadium in 2000. More than 54,000 fans attended the game against the Houston Astros. Aguilera grew up in Rochester, PA, about 30 miles from Pittsburgh. Three Rivers Stadium was built in 1970 as a replacement for Forbes Field in the Oakland neighborhood. It was the site of the first World Series game played at night, as well as the Pittsburgh Steelers' immaculate reception. The next year, it was imploded and replaced by PNC Park, which has been the home for the Pittsburgh Pirates for the past 18 years. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Trump's relationship with certain media outlets and the reporters who cover him has long been contentious even before he was elected. Possibly no other reporter has the extensive history covering Donald Trump as New York Times White House correspondent Maggie Haberman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and CNN analyst, is speaking in Pittsburgh this evening at Chatham University's Center for Women and Politics. Maggie Haberman, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
Maggie, were you predestined to be a journalist? I mean, your father worked at the New York Times, your mother in media communications.
Actually, if anything, it was the opposite. I think I was predestined not to do it. It had no appeal to me whatsoever. But when I graduated college in 1996, I couldn't get a job at a magazine, which is what I wanted to do, specifically women's magazines. I went to one interview after the other and got shot down and found out that there was a clerk opening at the New York Post called a copy kid. And I took the job, and it's at the time was about $40 a day, but they would send copy kids out once a week as general assignment reporters, and I was hooked on the newsroom by the second day.
All right, so you got hooked. Did it eventually become a consuming profession for you?
Yes, and I'll let you know when it stops being that. But it very much still is. Look, I love what I do, and I feel very grateful to do what I do. I can't imagine doing anything else. I feel privileged to do this job, but there is an adrenaline rush about getting the story and getting the story right and being first with the story, and that was the milieu I came up in, and it's still very much in me.
I should let our listeners know we're catching you in your car, so drive safely.
Thank you. I'm doing my best.
Okay. So you said day two, you sort of got it. But when did the political reporting bug get you?
Oh, that got me in 1999. My editor at the time, a man named Stuart Marks, who was one of the best Metro editors the New York Post ever had, sent me to City Hall. I think I was 26, and Rudy Giuliani was in the middle of his second term, and I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, but he was this larger-than-life figure, and he loved battling with the press, and he would hold, you know, three press conferences a day, and, you know, constantly poke at the reporters covering him. Does this sound at all familiar? Stop me if you've heard this one. But there is a lot stylistic that was very similar about the Rudy Giuliani of the 90s in New York City. To the style of Donald Trump as president. It's not a complete analog, but there are some similarities. I found it addictive and compelling, and it's where policy is made that affects millions of people's lives. And I stayed at City Hall for a very long time.
What was your reporter, source/newsmaker, Donald Trump, relationship like before his run for president?
Well, everybody who covers New York for a tabloid, especially in the 90s and the 2000s at one point or the aughts at one point or another, crossed paths with Donald Trump. I got to know him best during 2011 when he was considering running for president in 2012. And he had put together, actually, a much more extensive version of a proto-campaign than I think people realized until much later. And I went back in 2016, and I was looking at a lot of what he had said and done and worked on in 2011, and it was really basically the same themes. Very, very populist, very nationalist, with a strong economic focus. I spent a lot of time trying to understand not just what he was doing, but also why it was that he seemed to have such resonance with the GOP base in 2011, and he really did. I mean, he was heavily criticized for stoking the lie of birtherism around mm-hmm. President Obama, mm-hmm. But it did help him take hold with a certain group of voters. And so in 2015, one of his aides came to me and said, Trump is going to declare his candidacy on June 16th, and we want you to break it. And I said, no. And he said, why? It was his former aide, Sam Nunberg. And I said, because I spent a lot of time doing this in 2011, only to watch him announce he wasn't running during sweeps week for The Apprentice, and I'm not going to do this again until he actually runs. It was not the best call, maybe, in retrospect, but it was a defendable one because he had talked about running a lot and never had. So, I think that Donald Trump spends a lot of time being underestimated, and I think there's a part of him that both has a high level of grievance about being underestimated, but also is driven by it. And I think that will probably serve him well again in 2020.
I have to ask you, has that relationship, when you really started covering him a lot in 2011, has it changed to the 2016 election and even today covering the White House?
I just think that he has an unrealistic expectation of what media coverage is or is supposed to be. And I think that his understanding of the news media came from a relationship either with the business pages of certain papers or more specifically the gossip pages. He just fundamentally doesn't, I think, understand what a government-focused press corps does, that they are there to cover the institution. They're not there to cover the man personally. He just looks at the coverage in a way that, and look, no president likes their coverage. To be clear, no president and no elected official I've ever covered likes their coverage, but mm-hmm. he just views it through a deeply, deeply personal lens, which is the way he views most things. And I think it has just made everything sort of more caustic around him and for those of us who cover him.
Are you surprised at how he's approached the presidency at running the government?
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. No, he's exactly who I thought he was, and he does exactly what I thought he would do. I mean, it's funny. A lot of what he is doing is stuff that he said he would do during the campaign. And I continue to be surprised at the number of people who are shocked by what he's doing. You know, it would be like if Babe Ruth points the bat to the stands and said, I'm going to put it there, and people start laughing. And it's like, why are you laughing? I just told you where I'm going to put it. He's done much of what he said he was going to do. And for better or worse, however people feel about it, he has tried to adhere to much of what he promised.
Has he always been so quotable?
Has he?
Yeah.
He has always been so quotable. He was always known as a good quote when you were at the tabloid.
You mentioned your early political reporting, City Hall. I mean, there's reporting on City Hall, and then there is reporting on the White House. Aside from the difference in importance and the scope of, we'll call it the beat, has that changed you as a reporter, as an individual?
I think that it's funny. It's a really good question, and I guess I would answer it a slightly different way than you asked it. The reporting tradition of government in New York, and no, it is not the White House. It does not affect the whole country, but it is much more adversarial than I think the press corps typically has been in Washington, which is not to say that, again, presidents don't like the coverage, but the approach in New York is much more sort of smash mouth, punch people in the face with a 2x4 as an approach to covering government. And I often think about how Donald Trump actually would have handled it had he ever run for office in New York, which is something he thought about at one point. It's changed me just in the sense that I think I've had to adapt to some traditions of Washington that were not necessarily ingrained in me coming up in New York.
You mentioned earlier that you were hesitant to break the news about his declaration of his candidacy in 2015, but you wound up being the reporter covering the campaign. Do you regret that at all?
Not at all. No, I mean it was a history-making, fascinating candidacy. You know, I think that people are going to have a lot of difficulty understanding and processing this period in history, I think, and it's going to take some time. But he became president running for his first office ever. That's fairly unusual. I'm very happy that I covered this campaign.
So how did that longstanding relationship covering him as a New York City guy help you in your coverage of him as a presidential candidate?
I just think that I understood some of his perspective differently than I think some national reporters did. For instance, I would say it helped me understand his approach to the media, right? So one of the things that we saw him do during the campaign was he would call into a Sunday show instead of going to the studio, which was sort of unheard of before. You know, he'd call in to meet the press or he'd call into Stephanopoulos, and he would dangle himself out there almost as a commodity for some other people to seize on. So if one network wouldn't take him, you know, by phone, he'd find someone who would, and then he would get people sort of fighting for him. That was a practice that he honed over many years with the New York tabloids, and I completely understood what he was doing watching it. I think that kind of thing helped me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times White House correspondent Maggie Haberman, who will speak this evening at Chatham University's Center for Women in Politics. Maggie, Donald Trump likes to paint lots of media outlets as fake news, but the New York Times has borne the brunt of those White House rebukes, several times even calling its reporters out of control. Even with all that criticism, does he really care about what the Times does and reports about him?
Yes, he cares a great deal. And I think that if anybody wants to understand how Donald Trump actually feels about the New York Times, they will listen to this episode of The Daily, which is the podcast that the Times does with Michael Barbaro, where there was this back and forth between our publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, and the president, in the Oval Office at the end of July of this year, where we had, Peter Baker, my colleague, and I had just done an interview with the president, and our publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, was there because the president had tried inviting A.G. Sulzberger for dinner, and A.G. said no, but he would come see him if he would let his reporters interview him, and that did happen. But they got into this lengthy back and forth about sort of how the president views the coverage and what it is he hopes for from the coverage. And it's a fascinating window into his mind. In his mind, he is still this person from the outer boroughs in New York City. He is, you know, the developer from Queens who wants to be accepted. And he sees the Times as representative of the elites who didn't take him seriously. And he still wants the paper's, you know, as he sees it, approval.
Donald Trump has criticized your reporting, specifically tweeting that you are, quote, third rate, or were biased in favor of Hillary Clinton, yet he doesn't seem to shut you out. Why?
I mean, I can't speak for what's in his head. I can say that the tweet you're referring to specifically was almost a year to the date last year, and it was in response to a story I did about how Michael Cohen, his former personal attorney and fixer, might turn on the president and might cooperate with investigators. And the whole point of those tweets from the president was Michael Cohen would never do that. And I think that history has said which of us was correct.
The Times and other organizations have taken a lot of heat for using sparingly words, including lie, as in the president is lying. What's your take on that policy, using the word lie?
Look, my editor-in-chief has, our executive editor, excuse me, has a policy, Dean Baquet has a policy that he thinks that it should be used sparingly because he thinks that the word essentially loses meaning if you use it over and over again. And I think that is an understandable sentiment. I think that if people don't understand that he's not telling the truth, I'm not really sure that the label makes much of a difference.
When you speak,
I don't mean that he's never telling the truth. I just mean in instances when he's not, and when we say that, I don't think that the label necessarily carries more weight.
When you speak at an event such as this evening's, what do you glean from the audience? Are they more skeptical due to the president's battles with the media? Is there something else that you take away?
I take away that they are still trying to understand him. I take away that what his fights with the press don't make much sense to them, and they're struggling with it. But I think that they also think there might be some truth to it, and I think they're trying to understand a lot more about the methods that go into reporting and why, not just at the Times, but any news outlet, why we make the decisions we do. It is interesting to me that, you know, most of the audiences have asked some question or another about impeachment when I've made an appearance such as tonight's event. But this was all before the Mueller report was wrapped up and delivered to the Justice Department, and officials in the Democratic-held House started speaking differently about impeachment. So I'll be curious to see what I hear tonight.
Just a couple of quick more questions. President
Sure.
Trump has been criticized for how he uses social media. What are your thoughts on how journalists are, should be, maybe should not be using social media, say beyond a quote from a press briefing, an interview, a link to a story?
Look, I think as somebody who has used social media in ways that I'm not always happy with in retrospect, I think Twitter's has had some positive effects in terms of democratizing conversations, but I think that it has had a very, very, very deleterious effect in terms of spreading misinformation and in terms of amplifying a lot of misinformation and a lot of falsehoods. I don't just mean by the president, I mean by anyone. On Twitter, everything looks flat and equal and all the same. I think journalists need to be careful because of that. I think that journalists need to remember that they're not just having a conversation with each other in, you know, the press room on Twitter. I think if anything, the biggest problem is that journalists tend to treat Twitter like it's a Slack channel and they're just having, you know, a conversation in it. We're doing it all in public, in front of people. And what sounds like a joke to you or some witticism or something clever might not come off that way to a reader.
I mentioned before Donald Trump has called it, quote, the failing New York Times. Your executive editor has said more people read the Times than ever before, yet there are very real financial challenges for newspapers across the board competing for advertising revenue. How concerned are you about the future of newspapers and even political journalism as a whole?
I am incredibly worried about the future of journalism locally in this country. I think that it is true. You know, Trump often says that he's been good for business, and that is certainly true. I think he's been good for national outlets like The Times, like The Washington Post, and some others. There is a death of local journalism taking place, particularly at newspapers, and it breaks my heart and it terrifies me because it means that there is very little accountability for a lot of state houses, municipalities, local governments. I think it's a tragedy.
Maggie Haberman won a 2018 Pulitzer for team coverage of the Trump administration. The New York Times White House correspondent will speak this evening at Chatham University's Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics. Maggie, thanks so much for taking the time and drive safely.
Thanks for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, what some school districts in the region are doing to overcome a persistent achievement gap. And how are your brackets doing? No, not those brackets. The March Mammals Madness brackets. A visit with the curator of mammals at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.